Good morning. Here's the NBC News from around the world. This is James Stevenson reporting from the NBC Newsroom in New York. In a few moments, we'll call in NBC observers from overseas. But first, here are the late developments. Reports seeping through the news blackout on the Western Front indicate that furious fighting is in progress on the northern sector, where the German counterattack has driven approximately 18 miles into Belgium. Allied planes are smashing at German armored columns. In the Balkans, the Red Army is only 3 miles from Kassa in eastern Slovakia, threatening the German defense from Poland down to Hungary. General MacArthur's troops are continuing their push up Mindoro Island and meeting with little ground resistance. At the same time, United States headquarters in the Pacific reveal that 742 Jap planes have been put out of action in the past week. B-29s based in China today smashed at airplane factories in Omura, key town in western Kyushu Island, at the southern end of the Japanese homeland, while the Imperial headquarters claimed that 2 Allied warships and 2 transports were sunk off Mindoro. The Japanese claims were not confirmed by Allied headquarters. And now, a few words from your announcer.
Every report that has come back from the battlefront stresses this fact. Soldiers want letters from home more than anything else. Are you writing regularly to your soldier? And are you making sure that your letters reach him surely and quickly? You can make sure, you know, by using V-mail, the fast, sure, safe way of getting your letter in the hands of your soldier just as quickly as possible. V-mail flies. It saves precious cargo space. It's the ideal way to keep in touch with your fighting man. V-mail blanks can be obtained at drugstores, department stores, stationers, and at post offices. So don't take chances on delays. Use the fast, safe, and sure way every time you write. Write often and use V-mail. Now here's James Stevenson and your World News Roundup.
The German counterattack against the American First Army is not being taken lightly by Allied leaders. Neither is there any doubt in their minds that the drive will be stopped, although it will cost the Allies in great losses of men and material. Allied headquarters are maintaining a strict secrecy on the situation for security reasons, because any factual information of losses or the steps being taken to stop the German drive would be helpful to the enemy. However, there can be no doubt that we have lost considerable men and equipment. The Germans have advanced at least as far as the small Belgian town of Stavelo, about 18 miles from the German border. The attack was a complete surprise, which means that Allied units in its path were overrun. And as artillery is usually employed, depending on caliber, from between 2 to 5 miles behind the infantry combat lines, it is quite obvious that we must have lost considerable guns of various sizes. In addition, the average infantry division will fight on a front of approximately 6 to 7 miles, requiring a depth of about the same distance for deploying of troops and bringing up supplies and replacements, which means that the German drive on a front of around 70 miles must have involved at least 8 Allied divisions at a minimum and pushed them completely out of their positions. Such an action, depending on the speed with which it was accomplished, would naturally result in heavy losses to the defenders. The greater the speed, the greater the losses, particularly in prisoners taken. Of course, as I said before, there is an almost complete blackout of news of the fighting by Allied Supreme Headquarters. But military principles such as tactics are commonly known, and from the meager facts we have, it appears that we must be prepared for bad news when full reports are finally made. The Germans are suffering huge losses, too. Field Marshal von Rundstedt is throwing great masses of tanks and men into his drive with almost reckless abandon. It is questionable as to just how long he can keep up the pace. He has committed great numbers of his reserves, both men and equipment. The odds are completely against him in the long run. And the natural query, so far as military science is concerned, is where does he go from here and what can he accomplish in a final showdown? We have more reserves and much more material. We can take more losses than he can and still come up strong. In other words, it probably would have been wiser from the military viewpoint for the Germans to continue a holding defense such as they had organized along the Western Front, hoping to tire us out and thus win a negotiated peace. But having committed themselves to this counterattack, it will be much more difficult for them to play a holding game in the future, for they won't have the men and equipment with which to do it. Their losses now will make it impossible. But it may be that the Nazi game is to make this one last supreme effort and then they'll go down fighting, giving future generations of Germans an ideal upon which to build a new super race. In the meantime, the port of Antwerp may be endangered, and through Antwerp, much Allied supplies flow to the front. That would be a serious thing for us if we lost Antwerp. And now for our first report from overseas, we go to NBC in the Pacific.
This is Pat Flaherty speaking from the Philippines. Eyewitness accounts coming back from our beachhead and perimeter on Mindoro tell of our forces moving into a veritable paradise. Apparently, the little island did not suffer much from the Jap military rule. Conversation with two United States Army Signal Corps men, Lieutenant Jeff Luditz of New York City, photo unit officer, and PFC Bill Woodruff of Newton, Massachusetts, combat photographer, described the operation as being a perfect landing on a perfect beach. These two men went ashore in the first assault wave, but they said there wasn't even token resistance by the Japs. The Filipinos said the Japs had warned them that the Americans would strike Mindoro between December 12th and 20th. We hit it on the 15th. The area is ideal for airstrips, and our aviation engineers are ahead of schedule on their strip project. The two small strips formerly used by the Sugar Plantation Company were relics of the past and have been left as such. It won't be long before the Japs northward will be feeling the sting of these new air bases. When they fled to the mountains, the small Jap garrison force made little effort to destroy valuable equipment and machinery on the island. However, they smashed most of their weather and observation installation. 20 American pre-war foreign tractors painted of very bright yellow were found intact and ready for use. San Jose itself, said D.F.C. Woodruff, is very neat and attractive, just like a little New England farm village, although the new military traffic is kicking up a lot of dust. Talking with some of the Filipinos, Lieutenant Ludic learned of a very dramatic highlight. The Jap garrison commander told the native that he had a son, now serving in the United States.
We take you now to the NBC newsroom in New York. The rosy picture in the Pacific is offset somewhat by developments in Europe. For a first-hand report, we take you now to NBC in London.
This is Ed Hawker in London. Here is at home this morning, the one big subject of discussion has to do with the first U.S. Army front. Everywhere, people ask the same question: how are the Americans doing today? The answer, as we know, is that neither side is saying. There's still a security ban on dispatches from General Hodges' area of operations. And the Germans today are speaking in vague terms about the next few weeks, saying the next few weeks will require the last ounce of strength from the Reich, saying that grim battles await the German soldiers, that all the steadfastness Germans have learnt during the past tough months will be needed now. The one thing we do know, and this from General Eisenhower's morning communique, is that von Rundstedt continues to exert formidable pressure against the U.S. First Army, that the Germans are pouring transport and armor as well as paratroops into the thrust to an extent unknown since their initial onslaughts against the Normandy beachhead, that the greatest battle of the West is raging both in the air and on the ground, and that early indications point to heavy losses in men and materiel for both sides. The British generally take the attitude that von Rundstedt's drive is a terrific gamble for time. But realistically, they point to the apparent fact that the thrust was a surprise, to the obvious fact that the Nazis have reorganized after the German army's greatest defeat of all time, and their conclusion that such an achievement is clearly a military success. As for any comparison with Ludendorff's offensive in 1918, that's fantastic, in the words of one commentator. Based on false analogy, says another, if only because Ludendorff in 1918 opened up with final victory for the Germans in mind. Today, von Rundstedt can hope for no more than a postponement of the final Allied victory. In his late report, pointing up the situation on the Western Front today, the Prime Minister himself, here in Commons in London, said a great battle is proceeding now. He then went on to say, in answer to questions, that he did not expect to make any summing up of the situation before the new year, certainly not before Christmas. Elsewhere on the front, in General Patton's zone, mostly mopping up activity, progress slow. On the 9th U.S. Army front, the slightly rejuvenated Luftwaffe during the night raided both forward and rear areas, and General Simpson's army is being subjected to an almost continuous shelling by German artillery and mortars. And at the southern tip of the front, there's stiff fighting northwest of Kalmar. This is Ed Hawker in London, now switching you to NBC in Washington.
This is Leif Eade in Washington. And this morning, just about everything in Washington is foreign affairs. Ed Stettinius' statement on the Polish boundary question is seen here as holding the door open a little while longer for London's Polish government in exile to make a deal. If they don't hurry, then Stalin's likely to slam the door shut and sit down and talk business with the Soviet-sponsored Lublin Committee. But Washington's pretty much of a mind in thinking that the Polish boundary question will be settled soon on Moscow's terms. Our foreign policy is getting a thorough going over in the Senate. That coalition of three New Dealers and progressive Phil La Follette is holding up the vote on Joe Grew, Nelson Rockefeller, Will Clayton, Jimmy Dunn, Archie MacLeish, and General Holmes. Claude Pepper let go for almost 5 hours on the floor yesterday in what he calls a preamble. He wants to hold the nominations over till the next Congress. But Tom Connolly, who's trying to push these names through, says the whole thing's obviously a filibuster, and he talks about possible night sessions. Senators Vandenberg and Brooks want the president to outline a whole foreign policy. Even old High Johnson, one of the spearheads that killed the League of Nations over 20 years ago, spoke up in sympathy for Greece. And it begins to look as though Connolly's going to have to pull a letter from the White House to get his men voted on. Otherwise, in Washington, it begins to look as though Sewell Avery may get another free ride out of his offices. Montgomery Ward let the deadline pass last night for telling the War Labor Board it'll obey its wage orders. So now the case goes to the White House. Those new draft orders say that every man under 30 who has been rejected for service since last February, except those with obvious physical defects, must be re-examined in 1945. And maternity ward statisticians at the War Production Board say that the 1944 production of diaper cloth figures 34 yards for every one of our young citizens. This is Eade in Washington, returning you now to New York.
So far this morning, we've heard from NBC observers Pat Flaherty in the Philippines, Ed Hawker in London, and Leif Eade in Washington. Now here's your announcer, and then I'll be back with more news.
The most critical manpower problem facing our country today is not in the Army or the Navy or the war plants, serious as is the need for men in those classifications. America needs men most in the merchant marine, men to man the supply ships that carry the guns and shells and gas and trucks to the scene of action. A lot of men have left the merchant marine. America wants them to come back, along with thousands of other men with or without sea experience. As a matter of fact, America needs 43,000 new merchant seamen within the next 12 months. Mates, engineers of all classes, able-bodied seamen, firemen, oilers, water tenders, radio telegraphers, cooks, and telegraphers. If you qualify for any of these jobs, wire right now, COLLECT, to Merchant Marine, Washington, D.C., or apply at War Shipping Administration offices in major ports, maritime union halls, or U.S. employment offices in principal cities. And again, here's James Stevenson in the NBC newsroom.
The United States Office of War Information announced today that America, a monthly magazine designed to acquaint the Soviet people with the United States, has been placed on sale in Russia. The new publication is the first effort by the United States to circulate propaganda in the Soviet Union. It's printed in the Russian language, of course. Well, the Japanese are now being hit with made-in-Japan bombs. Of course, it's all for effect on Japanese morale. Japanese bombs captured at Tarawa have been used by the Army Air Forces, according to Colonel William S. McCullough, ordnance officer from Lieutenant General Millard Harmon's command. He said planes of the 7th Air Force dropped a few duds so the Japs could see that they were getting their own bombs right back. And another Japanese leader has left the war scene, according to a Tokyo broadcast which said Jinjiro Fujiwara, munitions minister, had resigned for health reasons and had been succeeded by Shigeru Yoshida, former welfare minister. And that's the morning's news from around the world. This is James Stevenson saying goodbye from the NBC newsroom in New York.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.